Speaking with Joy, a podcast about books, beauty, and music. So make yourself a cup of tea, sit down, and let's begin. There is but one good, that is God. Everything else is good when it looks to Him, and bad when it turns from Him. And the higher and mightier it is in the natural order, the more demoniac it will be if it rebels. It is not out of bad mice or bad fleas that you make demons, but out of bad archangels. The false religion of lust is baser than the false religion of mother love or patriotism or art, but lust is less likely to be made into a religion. Well, hello everyone, and welcome back to Reading with Joy. We are on chapter 11 of our summer book club on The Great Divorce, and I am so excited to talk to you about this week's chapter. Now, to me, this chapter is pivotal. It demonstrates the imaginative pull and force of what Lewis is trying to say to the same intensity that the chapter where we meet MacDonald kind of gets across the philosophical ideas. So what MacDonald kind of presents to us in the idea of self-choice or the choice for joy in that chapter where we meet him is really demonstrated really powerfully in this chapter. And the core idea of this chapter, as I think is really the whole book, is that goodness is not about the type of desire, but whether or not that desire is baptized, if it dies and rise again and is directed towards its true end, which is God. And what we have in this chapter, to give you a little overview narratively, we're presented with two of these little dialogues, right? Most of these are presented around these dialogues between the ghost and the spirit. And in this, and it's always kind of representing this choice between self-choice and the choice for joy, of letting desire stop within ourselves, of, you know, the feelings and the world that we create that's kind of an illusion within ourselves, or desires that lead us beyond what we desire towards God. The desires that use desire properly. That's always what these dialogues are presenting. And in this, we're presented with two different characters. And what Lewis does is surprising, because on the one hand, we have a character who seems almost hopeless in some ways, and she represents the desire or the affection of mother love. And that's something we think of as holy and good and something that that shouldn't lead us to hell. But she seems to be having troubles with this. And then the second person we see is someone who struggles with lust. And it almost seems like it's a weaker thing that's more easily redeemed. And Lewis does this to kind of shock us out of our normal ideas of what is good and what is bad. Because it is so easy to think that someone who struggles with lust is somehow worse than someone who makes an idol out of mother love. And I think the point that Lewis is really trying to make to us is it doesn't matter the desire. What matters is if it's directed towards God, if you love within God. And it matters that this desire, this kind of comes to be this image of it, is baptized. If it's killed and rises again in its true form, in the way that leads us truly towards God. So that's kind of the key of what we're going to look around this week. And let's start by looking at the character of mother love. We've got Pam and Michael. And Lewis describes this as one of the most painful scenes. We see a mother is brought to heaven, and she immediately asks, where is her son? And she's kind of disappointed when this, when the spirit says that he is further up in the mountains and that he can't even see her. Now, in some ways, this character is kind of the opposite of the last chapter, because while the last chapter kind of blatantly is like, well, he didn't give me what I wanted, this character thinks that she has laid down everything in her life to help Michael, her son, live a good and fruitful life. And she honestly feels really bothered that she's given up her whole life and that she can't see Michael. And we see immediately what comes out is that her issue is that even though she loved Michael, her love was a possessive love, right? We talked about that last time. She, like the character in last chapter, sees Michael as an extension of herself. Her whole world is wrapped up in Michael. So while the last character, her whole world was wrapped up in her own needs and desires, in this chapter, this woman has kind of wrapped up her whole world in the needs and desires of another person, but in so doing has really still trapped him in her own world because she's making a self-choice rather than a choice for God. And so Pam sees it as her job to give up everything for Michael, to tend to every need. And we could see that as kind of this inherently self-sacrificial love, but obviously something has gone wrong. And I think her problem is that she regards Michael as a possession. She does not love him in God, she just loves him. And so ultimately, her love becomes almost predatory. And she, it's funny because she can't see this. Again, it's like last week's, not last week's, but the last episode. Her own self-choice has made her kind of blind. Because she won't accept anybody else's interpretation of herself, it's made her blind. And she actually kind of refuses to come into heaven because she refuses to believe that God would say that Michael wasn't hers alone. She has this belief that she deserves to possess Michael. Which is really kind of creepy. And one thing I would say is something that annoys me a bit is that I feel like Lewis only portrays women as having possessive loves, which is obviously not true. Men also have possessive loves. And so that's a bit odd. And I wish that he would have at least kind of balanced this out with other examples of this. But I guess he believes only men are cynical. So he's stereotyping a bit. We'll forgive him. But I thought it was worth noting that. So her issue, the reason she stays out of heaven, is she says, "I don't believe in a God who would keep mother and son apart. I believe in a God of love. No one has a right to come between me and my son, not even God. Tell him, God, that to his face. I want my boy, and I mean to have him. He is mine, do you understand? Mine, 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 forever and ever." And the spirit says to her, "He will be, Pam. Everything will be yours. God himself will be yours, but not that way." So to me, what the issue is with Pam is that she has this sense of possession. She believes that, and we talked about this a while back with the ghost who tries to take the apple back to earth or to hell. And what he had to learn was that everything is a gift, and that to experience love or desire, you have to begin to experience the world not as a possession that you see, that you seize, that you kind of grasp, but as a gift that you receive. And obviously, she doesn't see Michael as a gift that she receives. She sees him as something that is owed to her. And that's why I think it's so interesting. The spirit doesn't say to her, "No, Pam, Michael is not yours." Instead, what he says is, "He will be yours, but you have to receive him as he is," which is a gift that comes from God. And that ultimately, the person that this flows from is God. But the reason she kind of allows herself to stay in this state where she thinks that her, basically her idolatry and her possessiveness is good, is that she's kind of sanctified her possessiveness with these kind of pseudo-religious terms. She has said that there's nothing higher than a mother's love. And I think this happens so often. We can justify some of our own attitudes when we put it in religious language. We can justify manipulating people when we put it in religious language. And she's really done this. She's come to believe that her one fault, her possessiveness, that obviously didn't make anyone happy, she's justified it in these kind of religious terms. She said, "There's nothing higher or holier than this." And that really comes back to that quote that I opened up with, the idea that this high, really fundamental, important love, because mother love is important, it can more easily become kind of demonized, can more easily become a power for bad, simply because people can sanctify it and think that it's good all on its own. And the spirit notices this. He says, Pam, no natural feelings are high or low, holy or unholy in themselves. They are only holy when God's hand is on the rein. They all go bad when they set up and make themselves into false gods." So this is what's happened, is essentially she's made a feeling good in itself. She's forgotten that all desires should ultimately lead towards their object in God, which is to recognize that their object does not have their final realization within her, which is how she's treating Michael. That all objects of desire have their foundation in God, which means that to love something truly is always to love it in God and not to love it just by itself. And so because of that, she's set up her own affection. She's kind of sanctified it and made it holy in her own terms, and she's ultimately made it into a false god. So what is the solution to this? Now, we kind of leave this conversation before it finishes, so we're left to believe that there might still be hope for Pam. But in his conversation with McDonald, Lewis reveals what needs to happen for Pam. And the first thing is that she needs to admit that she didn't really love Michael well. And this comes down to the idea that when we don't love people in God, when we don't, as we talked about in the last episode, set them before us as something that is ultimately different and separate from us, that's a holy reality, that is something that we regard, not something that we see as an extension of ourselves, then we can't really love them. And when we love them as extensions of ourselves, we're really loving an illusion. We're not loving the fullness of the person in God. And so really the first thing she has to do is she has to admit that she didn't love Michael well. That's the kind of one myth that she's wrapped up herself in for her whole life. And so she gets kind of huffy and she says to the spirit, "So you just think everything's wrong. Everything I've done is wrong." And the spirit says, "But of course," shining with love and mirth so that my eyes were dazzled. "That's what we all find out when we reach this country. We've all been wrong. We all find that when we reach this country. We've all been wrong. That's the great joke. There's no need to go on pretending that one was right. After that, we begin living." So the first thing she has to do is she has to give up the narrative that she has spun for herself. She has to recognize, just like we were talking about the last episode, that she doesn't know everything, even about herself. She doesn't know anything about her love. She has to give up that she might have been wrong. That's her first step, is to admit that she didn't love Michael well because she loved him. She loved an illusion of him that was wrapped up in her own selfishness. And then the second thing she needs to do is that she needs to learn to love something other than Michael. And the spirit says this, "You know, I don't need to say you have to love something more than Michael. You just have to love something other than Michael first." She needs to turn away from this false god and turn towards something, anything beyond her. And I think what's interesting is that this is kind of a corrective to the last chapter, because in the last chapter we had the sense that to truly regard someone is to pull yourself out of yourself. But it's not enough simply to love someone. You have to love someone and love them for who they are in God. And this is her whole issue, is that the spirit says she treats him as a means to Michael. I'm sorry. I'm very tired. She treats God as a means to Michael rather than treating God as something that she should love and desire alone in itself. So it's not only that she has to learn to love something other than Michael, but really that she has to learn to love God. And in this scene, it seems like it's so far from that. But I love that he leaves us with this bit of hope. He says, if only they'll find a small spark of desire for God within that. They'll fan it into flame. But the whole house will be set on fire. So this is what we see with her, is that she has loved an illusion because she loved Michael as an extension of herself. She has to admit that she didn't love Michael well. She has to begin to love something other than Michael. But how does she do that? And this is what we're given in this quotation. All desires must, what does it say? I read it. All desires must die and rise again. We have this quote where the spirit is saying to Lewis kind of how this process will take place. And I think it's really interesting and beautiful and poignant that he says, you can't be the person to tell everyone how their desire has to die, because not all of us have experienced the pain that others have, and so you can't speak to it until you've experienced that pain. But he says, "No, no, son, that's no office of yours. You're not a good enough man for that. When your heart has been broken, it will be time for you to think of talking." I love that, and I think that is such a poignant thing that we all need to remember, that sometimes it is not our office to correct people's loves, even if they are gone astray. When your heart has been broken, it will be time for you to think of speaking. Not even speak yet, think of speaking. And then he goes on to say, "But someone must say in general what's been unsaid amongst you many this year, that love, as mortals understand the word, isn't enough. Every natural love will rise again and live forever in this country. But none will rise again until it has been buried." So here we have this very, it's very reminiscent of places in the Gospels where Jesus says, "You must become a seed and die, and then you'll bear much fruit." And so we have this idea that what needed to happen with Pam was that her desire needed to die and rise again. That her holy and good, oh my gosh, I think we're having a murder of crows outside my window. I don't know if you can hear them. So what needed to happen with Pam was that her desire needed to die and rise again. And then immediately after this, we're presented with a character who does just that, whose desire dies and rises again. And what's interesting is that Lewis chooses lust as the desire that will die and rise again. And I think it's important that he does this because he's making the point again that it doesn't matter what kind of desire it is, you know, that's askew. A desire, a mother-love desire, will not lead you closer to God than lust if it doesn't die and rise again. So he chooses lust, this kind of icky thing, this thing that we don't want to be in heaven. And use it to say that any desire can be redeemed if it is baptized. If it dies, is resurrected, and is directed towards God. Now, I think it's fun to note that this particular scene, I didn't realize this until reading it again. Actually, doing this bit, I was writing a bit on Augustine in my chapter for my PhD, and I realized that this scene comes almost directly out of Augustine's Confessions, when Augustine of Hippo, a very important church father, describes his own conversion. And so basically what we see here is we see the perverted desire of sexual desire. So if we're looking at the last one was mother love, this affection. In this we see the perverted desire of sexual desire. And so let me read you a bit from Augustine's conversion. And this is, I think it's in book 8. Nope, it's in book 14. All right, so in this, Augustine says, he's about to be converted. He says, I was held back by mere trifles, the most paltry inanities, my old attachments. They plucked at my garment of flesh and whispered, are you going to dismiss us? From this moment on, we will never be with you again, forever and ever. From this moment, you will never be allowed to do this thing or that forevermore. So I was delighted to discover that that sounds exactly like this ghost. You know, we're having this sense that that this ghost kind of seems like he is Augustine. And that's what's described as he's saying to redeem his desire, he has to once and for all, he can't keep any of the trinkets of heaven, as Lewis says in the beginning. He has to totally kill this desire. But not because the desire is bad in itself. Sexual desire is not bad at the heart of it, because it's misdirected. And so, but what I think is interesting is that, like Augustine, Lewis makes the point that for our desires to be redeemed, they can't just be killed by God. We have to allow them. We have to purposefully ourselves allow them to be put to death. We have to choose with our will. It's a really important idea for Augustine. He says we have an intellect, desires, and will. And it's funny, Augustine's a little bit kind of like, intellect is important, but what's really human, what really makes us human, is desire that should pull us towards God, but often doesn't, and will, which is the thing that kind of moves us towards that desire. So for Lewis and for Augustine, redemption consists in an act of the will to push desire towards God. And that's really evident in this chapter where you have the spirit. It's almost comical how he keeps on saying, okay, well, do you want to be redeemed? Okay, well, let me kill your desire. Let me kill the lizard that, you know, the lust is depicted as this red lizard, the lust lizard, as I like to call him. And so he is asked, I think it's 12 times the ghost is asked if the lizard can be killed. And that's to depict the reality that God will not make us give up our desires. He will not make us ever come close to him. He respects our difference, our separateness even, in a way that all the other ghosts can't. So he has to decide of his own accord to give over this desire and to let it be killed. And he's asked 12 times, and finally, in a moment of desperation, he gives into it. And I love Lewis does all these little plays on words, you know, where earlier he says that's damned nonsense, because it's nonsense, it's actually leading someone to damnation. And in this, the ghost says, oh, God, help me, God, help me. And on the one hand, it's supposed to be kind of an outcry of exasperation and exhaustion. But on the other hand, it represents that at the end of it, we can't make this act of will on our own. Part of the act of will of being redeemed is saying, I need God. I'm contingent on God. I need God to help me to turn my will towards him. And so in this final moment, he turns his will towards God. He says, God, help me, God, help me. And the spirit kills the desire. And then it becomes something new. I'm going to read you this this passage that's so beautiful. It says, for one moment, I could make out nothing distinctly. Then I saw, between me and the nearest bush, unmistakably solid but growing every moment solider, the upper arm and shoulder of a man. Then brighter still, the legs and hands, the neck and golden head materialized, while I saw an immense man. While I watched, and if my attention had not wavered, I should have seen the actual completing of a man, an immense man, naked, not much smaller than the angel. What distracted me was the fact that at the same moment something seemed to be happening to the lizard. At first I thought the operation had failed. So far from dying, the creature was struggling and growing even bigger as it struggled. And as it grew, it changed. Its hinder parts grew rounder. The tail, still flicking, became a tail of hair that flecked with huge and glossy buttocks. Suddenly, I started back, rubbing my eyes. What stood before me was the greatest stallion I had ever seen, the silvery white with a mane and tail of gold. It was smooth and shining and rippled with swells of flesh and muscle, whinnying and stamping its hoofs. At each stamp, the land shook and the trees dindled. The new made man turned and clapped the horse's neck. It nosed his bright body. Horse and master breathed into each other's nostrils. The man turned from it, flung himself at the feet of the burning one, embraced them. When he rose, I thought his face shone with tears, but it may have only been liquid love and brightness. One cannot distinguish them in that country. Which flowed from him. I had not long to think about it. In joyous haste, the young man leapt upon the horse's back. Turning in his seat, he waved farewell and nudged the stallion with his heels. They were off before I knew well what was happening. There was riding, if you like it. I came out as quickly as I could among the bushes to follow them with my eyes, but already they were like a shooting star far off the green plain and soon among the foothills of the mountain. Oh, this scene is so beautiful to me. And what it depicts is what Lewis thinks happens when we allow our desires to be baptized. What was ultimately being asked of this man was not to have his desire killed and done away with, but to have it transformed. And that's what we see was ultimately being asked of Pam. She was not being asked to have her desire, simply her desire or her mother love, be done away with forever, but to have it be baptized, have it die and resurrect, and to be ultimately transformed. And so what we see in this character is that the desire that kept him out of heaven literally becomes the desire that ushers him in. The lizard that whispered in his ear, this little lustful lizard that kept him out of heaven, becomes the stallion that gallops and pulls him into heaven. And I think this makes a really profound statement about desire, which is that no desire at its heart, according to Lewis, and this is a very Augustinian idea, is ultimately bad. What all desires need to be done is to be brought before God, nailed to the cross, and resurrected in their true and holy form. And when they are resurrected, they can become the very thing that pulls us towards God. And I want to end with giving you this idea from one of my favorite saints, Saint Macrina, who I wrote about a bit in one of my, a bit of my PhD. And Macrina writes about desire, and I think it's really what's depicted here. Actually, Macrina does not write about it. Macrina, and I'll talk about this at a different point, I think one of the podcasts, devote a whole podcast to her because she's so amazing. Gregory of Nyssa records kind of this conversation between him and his sister. Macrina says that desire comes from the fact that we are embodied creatures, right? We're not just souls, we are bodies. And because we have bodies, we need things. We need food, we need sleep, we need shelter, we need sex, we need all of these, we have these needs. And Macrina says that God creates us with those needs, and that because of having a body, we have desires. But that those desires serve as this constant reminder that we need God. And that if we let them, they can be the thing that pulls us towards relationship, union, and delight in God. And I think that's ultimately what Lewis is portraying. We see that when these people use these desires, these loves, these affections, when they let them die and rise again, they become what they were truly meant to be, which is something that pulls us towards God. And that's something in my life that's been really influential, is when I have an issue or a sin or something that's hung up, rather than just hating myself for it and saying, oh, this is such a bad thing, instead I try to bring it to God and say, how can this thing be redeemed? How can it be brought to life? How can it become the stallion that pulls me into the deep and good and green country? And that, I think, is one of the most profound things we can draw from this whole book, really, is that no desire is ultimately evil, but that every desire must be transformed and it must be baptized. So I encourage you to think about that this week. When you come to reckon with sins or issues or things that trip you up in your life, stop condemning yourself for it and instead say, how could God redeem this desire, this issue, this brokenness, so that it becomes the stallion that leads me into the heavenly country? Well, that's all I have for you today, folks. I will look for you next week, and we'll be doing chapter 12, and I can't wait to talk to you then. Have a lovely week, and we'll talk soon.